how tough was that to navigate this thing that's supposed to be so great and then losing a close teammate?
You can only imagine, you know, the agony. The teacher said, was asking all the kids what their dads did for a living. And it comes to Michael, he says, my dad goes to the airport and makes bread.
And that's what he thought he did.
That's what he thought I did.
Mario Andretti is the 1978 Formula One World Champion. In his career, he has 12 wins, 19 podiums, 18 poles, and all that in 128 starts. Today, we talk all about Mario Andretti and Formula One. How did he get into it? Who are the right people to talk to get those opportunities? Being able to afford it. I feel like that is something that is so talked about today in motorsports, is the financial aspect. Well, Mario Andretti had to deal with that himself. We talk dangers, and he really opens up about losing people that were close to him. You know, what if it's himself who gets caught up in a bad accident and maybe won't get out of it? He shares those thoughts about navigating the world of the dangers of motorsports. We learn more about Mario's family, his wife Deanne, the relationship that they had. He also shares a very funny story about one of his sons at career day. You might have heard a little bit of it in the teaser. It's one of my favorite stories that he shares. This in particular, I'm very excited for everyone to be able to listen to. So enough of me rambling about it. Here's more of my conversation with Mario Andretti. You mentioned being pushed away in a dirt car and you're already thinking about F1. Was that the dream since you first laid eyes on it? Like, when did that become ingrained in your mind, like, I'm going to be an F1?
Well, you have to go back. I mean, how it's Formula One that I was, you know, Aldo and I were gravitated to the sport because that's where we were exposed.
Yeah.
With, you know, at a young age, during our teenage years in Italy. And coming to America, obviously, you had to, you know, once I got into racing, once you get to the top level, Formula One was in my head. I said, hopefully, God willing, someday I'll have the opportunity. And listen to this, in 1965, I finished third here, and I was Rookie of the Year. And throughout the month, I really tried to befriend Jim Clark and Colin Chapman.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a lot of conversation and so forth. And and I have some nice photos, you know, together. And so at the banquet, you know, Jim Clark won, I finished third. So at the banquet, when we were saying our goodbyes, I said to Colin Chapman, I said, Colin, someday I'd like to do Formula One. He said, Mario, when you think you're ready, you call me and I'll have a car for you. Can you imagine what those words meant? And so, again, so I said, now I gotta start road racing. And can you imagine, like, in 63, 2 years before, there was only one road race. Midgets, we ran Lime Rock, Connecticut. And I won it. And then in 65, I lobbied like crazy, you know, to USAC, to expand the series, you know, to be as versatile as possible, because we had part of the championship was of course all the ovals, but then also was the dirt races,
right.
You know. So and they had one road race, which was here in near Indianapolis at Raceway Park.
Yep.
And they had one road race, and I won that. You know, so then they started, in the IndyCar, we started going to Canada, you know, to Mossport, Saint-Gervais. Then we started going to Riverside. And so all of a sudden, you know, I was much more part of that. And that's when, you know, Dan Gurney actually used to do a lot of these road races in IndyCars, because he was doing Indy also, you know. sporadically. And and then I was able to join the Le Mans program for Ford, which was an incredible amount of testing being done there. And I said, I'm available for all of it, you know. And we became very good friends with Bruce McLaren. And he and I, you know, obviously after day of testing, we used to spend time and go to dinner and talk. And I used to, you know, go into his brain, you know, and he was a very technical driver. So I felt that I learned quite a bit from him. I think I had the high speed stuff, you know, pretty well, you know, okay. But I just needed all the healing, all the braking, all the approach to the hairpins and all that sort of thing. And he taught me a lot of that. And then, you know, we won Sebring together in 67. And then in 68, I called Colin Chapman.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I said, I'd like to do the last two races of the season. And he said, right. I said, I'll have a car for you. So the last two races was Monza,
yep,
and Watkins Glen. Mm-hmm. And so I said, great, Monza, you know. And so obviously we were going to do a test. We did that a week before the race. And it went really well. You know, the comparison I had at that time was an Indy car, which, you know, obviously much heavier car, and the Formula One car felt so nimble, so responsive. Mm-hmm. I felt so good in it. And I set a good time in Monza. In fact, I was quicker than Chris Amon had been with a Ferrari 4 days earlier. But there was a glitch here. To race in Monza, we had to come back here and race at the Hoosier 100,
yeah,
on the dirt, because I was going for the championship, and so was Bobby Unser.
Bobby Unser, yep.
And so I got Bobby Unser a ride in a BRM so he could drive in Monza so we could do slipstreaming, because in those days, every single time you were on the track for practice, the time counted for qualifying, by the way.
Oh.
So we were able to put in a qualifying time on the first practice of the Friday, and then we had a plane at 2:40 to come to the States and race Saturday, and then go back to race in Italy on Sunday. And we had an agreement with the track promoter, you know, Bacigalupi, and also the FIA arm in Italy, Count Lorani, that they would waive the 24-hour rule, because you know, USAC, you know, like Indy, they were part of the FIA, you know, part of FIA, so they had to adhere to the rule, which was a 24-hour rule. You could not race within 24 hours, in any major event, so to speak. So they were going to waive that, and we did that. Bobby and I, we qualified, and in fact, it was quite a bit quicker, you know, at the time, but nobody's really going for it, you know, the first practice. But nevertheless, we come back. In fact, I finished second to Foyt here at the Hoosier 100, and we go back. And my car was seventh on the grid, even with the time that I set in the first practice. Mm-hmm. And there was a protest. And to this day, I don't know exactly, but I think it was Ferrari that protested, because, you know, they prevailed. And the only one that could... there was no one that could speak Italian at the protest, because and so Colin Chapman, you know, he was there, and he said, well, cannot drive. And so we didn't get to start that race. And but the first start, and it was a Watkins Glen. And I put the car on pole there. And I was surprised myself, like, but you can't believe the feeling that I had at that point. And who was next to me? It was Jackie Stewart, world champion, yeah. You know. You know, to have those moments, you know, in your career, I mean, you can just, you can't believe it, you can, you know. Am I taking it for granted? I mean, I'm so fortunate, so blessed, you know, to have had those opportunities.
I want to unpack those two starts, or the one start, but the attempt at Monza. I heard there's a story where you and Bobby were stopped by security going into the track.
Yes.
What was the story?
We didn't have our credentials with us, you know, even though a mechanic picked us up at the airport. And in fact, we had to pluck him out of the seat because he wasn't fast enough. Bobby plucked him out of the seat for me to drive. So we get to that, and it was, and the Carabinieri, which is the military, actually were the ones you had to go through there. You have to have credentials. And I go there, and I nothing. And Bobby said, don't go. He said, the guy's got his hand on his gun.
Oh, my God.
So I took a fortune. I could speak Italian, you know, but they got us. But they, at all, they didn't put us in jail.
But he gunned it, right?
But I gunned it, yeah. Just took off.
That had to be a stressful start to the day.
Yeah, nothing new.
Nothing new. Is that pretty typical then? Oh, man.
We had moments like
that.
Yeah.
How was it traveling back and forth? Like, did you get jet lagged? Like, the time zones throw you off having to do this?
You know, the good thing for me, I think I've always been a good traveler because I could sleep on a plane and so forth. And, you know, you make the best of it. You know, what else? You have no other choice, you know. But, and, you know, with first class, or at least, you know, you had, you know, a decent seat and so forth. But, I remember that when we left after the Hoosier 100, you know, we had to be on the plane, and I don't remember this clearly. I think that we borrowed, a lira from Roger Penske. I'm not 100% sure, but I know we did something like that to get us to Boston. Because Boston had a TWA flight that time at 8 o'clock at night to go to Milan. And that's what we did. That's what we took. And but we were there, you know. Made the race.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
You mentioned putting the car on pole at Watkins Glen. What a feeling that felt like. How did the first F1 start go?
Well, you know, obviously it was my first start ever, and Jackie beat me into the first corner, you know, which was fine, which was perfect for me because I wanted to just have a feel of what the pace was going to be and so forth. And things, you know, were going okay. I didn't have, unfortunately, as a third car, I didn't have the best engine I had, and the clutch, you know, started going, early in the race. I was running second, you know, to him. And I dropped out, you know, clutch slipping. So that was it.
After that, what's the future for F1 like for you? Did you know there was something down the line? What were the conversations like?
Well, yes. I mean, Colin, you know, we bonded, you know, to some degree, and I did a couple of races the following year, you know, and this South Africa, I remember, I hadn't finished one yet, and then I did the Nürburgring with a four-wheel drive, which was a takeoff from the Indy four-wheel drive car I had in 69, and that car was very fragile, and I remember at the start of the race at Nürburgring when we come over the, you know, the Flugplatz, which is called the airport, when the car just goes all four wheels off the ground. When it landed, left front wheel just snapped right off, you know, the hub. And then I didn't crash, pull over the side, you know, but, and actually, you know, I was fast enough that I think Colin was impressed, you know, that, and he offered me a ride. I couldn't afford it. Financially, I just couldn't afford to do Formula One at the time because, you know, involved, you know, with this, with my contracts with Firestone and what I had going here, and things were going quite well for me. I just couldn't afford to do it. But I wanted to keep my hand in it.
Yeah.
And then, I was driving sports cars, started driving some sports cars for Ferrari. And then, and Ferrari, you know, I talked them into giving me a ride in South Africa in 1971. To get ahead of that, in 1970, once I was involved with the STP, you know, with Andy Granatelli, it was a heavy sponsorship with the March team. And so we had our own car. So in 1970, I drove, you know, quite a few of the races. The best finish was a third at Spain. But we had sporadic races, you know, one race in Austria, I got upside down, I had throttle stuck, went over the wheel of Pedro Rodriguez's car. So it was kind of a short season there. But then, you know, with my association with Ferrari, I expressed, you know, my desire to do some Formula One, not full time. And we did South Africa, which I had my first win there as a third car to win the race.
It's pretty good.
It was pretty good. Felt pretty good. And then, but right after that, they had the non-championship race in Ontario, the Twin 100s, because the reason they had Twin 100s because they had some Formula 5000 cars there and didn't have a tank big enough to go the full Grand Prix distance. So they split it. They did Twin. And what's interesting there that Jack Eakes was my teammate, you know, at Ferrari, and qualifying for the... I had to qualify on Friday because on Saturday I was driving a Champ Car race, IndyCar race in Phoenix.
Oh, man.
And I was really in a rush to get my time in, and it was one of the Can-Am drivers was driving a Formula 5000 car. I tried to pass him on the outside at one point, and he put me out in the gravel, and I went into the guardrail. And so, I had set a time, you know, but it was deep in the field, like midfield or something. And so I had to go to, you know, to Phoenix and then come back. And they fixed the car. They had, they went to one of the local, Kuzma, some of those shops, you know, they did a good job. And in the morning, and I think Jack Eakes actually ran my car, you know, to just check it out, everything was okay. And from midfield, there's a bam, bam, bam. I won that race. I won the first one, and Jackie Stewart for the second. And the second one, both he and I started in front, and he took the lead. And the third lap, I passed him, and I won both of those races.
Oh, man.
And then that was, and Mr. Ferrari called me to the factory, and he offered me a Formula One full-time job as a number one, and I couldn't take it. I just, again, like I said, the earning power just wasn't there in Formula One. I had to think of that because I had a young family, and financially, I was, quite honestly, I was doing really well here, and I had to be thinking those terms because, yeah, you know, something happens to me, you know, and there's too much of that going on. And I felt that responsibility. And so I figured my day will come, you know, to do Formula One. And I still did a few off, you know, jobs. And then in 1970, once I joined the Pirelli team, I started thinking of Formula One. And I talked them into to actually fielding or entertaining entering Formula One, and we did, you know, in 1975. And finally, because in 74, I had a really good run with them in Formula 5000. I think we won almost every race that we finished. We didn't finish so many. We were second in the championship both years, but Formula 5000 was really, really, actually taught me a lot. It was, basically, as fast, they were as fast as a Formula One car, so that was a good thing for me. And we had the designer, which was one of the Lotus designers, Maurice Philippe, that was actually hired by the Pirelli Group, you know, to do the Indy cars. And so his task was to design the Formula One car that we were going to race in 75. 1975, and that's the first time that I went full-time, except racing at Indy, but full-time Formula One. And you know, the car that was designed actually was actually not, it was like a two-year-old design, basically. That's what Maurice Philippe had. And the car was okay, but it was not going to be able to win. I think we might have won if we won a broken link, a toe link, we might have won the street race in Barcelona, because I got into the lead. I passed James Hunt for the lead, mm-hmm. and I was leading that race very nicely, but I had started about sixth or seventh, I think, and at the start, I had a contact with Clay Regazzoni with my right rear, and somehow I must have compromised the toe link, because during the race, finally, that snapped, and then I was out of the race. And that was probably, that would have been the best performance. I know we could have won that race if it would have been. But nevertheless, time goes on, and at the beginning of the 76 season, here we are at the Long Beach, and I'm sitting in a car for the start, and Chris Economaki puts a mic to me and says, "Mario," he says, "what's your response that Val and Pirelli Jones decided to withdraw from Formula One after this race?" I said, "Oh my goodness." I said, I don't know what to say. I never, you know, they never discussed that with me. So that was the news.
That's how you found out?
That's how I found out.
And you obviously said what you said to Chris Economaki. You said, "That's the first I've heard of it." But what internally are you thinking in that moment?
It was devastated.
Yeah.
I was devastated because at that point, like you said, at that point I had decided I want to devote, you know, time in my career, you know, to do Formula One full time. Unfortunately, all the seats that were offered to me were occupied.
Right.
There was no chance for me to go with Ferrari or Lotus at the time. They had their driver lineup. And with the Pirelli group, here again, I go to a negative turning into a positive.
Yeah.
Because the next day, we're staying at Queensway Hilton in Long Beach, and I'm having breakfast by myself. My wife didn't even want to join me. I was so miserable. And so I'm sitting there by myself, and I'm looking across, and there's Colin Chapman by himself. And we're looking at each other, so I joined him. And one thing led to another. I said, Colin, I said, I'm out of Formula One. I said, if you ever need a hand, you know, someone, I said, I'm there for you. And he said, Mario, I don't have a good car. I wish I had a good car for you, but you want to drive for me? He said, you can be, and I said, if you consider me number one on the team, because I know a number one always had the best engine and everything. He says, you got it. He said, but we don't have a good car. I said, we'll make it. We'll make it a good car. We'll work on it. That was the best day of my life again. I said, now we go, and with Lotus. And Colin Chapman, the reason that they were not so competitive, he had so many distractions. You know, he was a man with so many goals. You know, he was very ambitious. And he started a boat company, the car company at the time. And so Formula One was not his priority. And that's why they were not really as competitive as obviously they knew to be. And I said, Colin, I said, you got to come back racing full time. And his wife Hazel said, that's the best thing you could have said to him. You know, and he did. I said, just delegate responsibility, I said, to the car company and to somebody else. I said, but come back racing. And that's what he did. That was, you know, and we made the car better and better. We had a couple of podiums, and we won the very last race of the season, which was Japan, which you figure, okay, it was in the rain, you know.
Yep.
No, I was on pole in the dry. So that's important. It was not that just because it was a rain race. And so that was so encouraging for the team. There's nothing better for any team than to win the last race of the season, you know. And he said the words to me that I hear again, I'll never forget. I said, Mario, he said, next year's car is going to make this one look like a London bus. That's what he said. I said, right, you know. And so that's what you always, you know, you have to look forward to. And that was the beginning of something good after that.
Yeah, I've never heard the London bus phrase.
That's what he said.
And was he right?
He was right.
He was right. Yeah.
He was right.
As you said, big things coming. F1 World Championship in 1978. What do you remember about that season?
When you have, you know, the car that you know that can do it, if we can finish races, you know, I think 77 would have been even easier World Championship than 78. We couldn't finish a race. You know, what we finished was usually winning. But 78 was magic, obviously. We were able to put it all together. And, you know, can you imagine also clinching the World Championship in Monza, you know, where my dream started. Unfortunately, under the worst circumstances, by losing my teammate, you know, Ronnie Peterson. But, you know, that's the way it goes sometimes. But looking back at everything, how things happen, I come full circle on so many things. You know, I felt so incredibly blessed again, over and over.
I heard people describing what that race and the highs of winning and clinching the title and the lows of losing your teammate. I know what kind of toll that must have taken on you. How tough was that to navigate this thing that's supposed to be so great and then losing a close teammate?
Like, yeah, that? I mean, you can only imagine, you know, the agony. And then I'm looking, you know, my wonderful wife, you know, knowing this can so real, how it can happen. We lost so many of our closest friends, you know, all of that, you know, and then you try not to dwell on that negative. And you feel for the other family. And, you know, we were so close, you know, we were buddies, really buddies. And I mean, that was a cruel part of the sport, obviously, no question. And it's, you know, it's tough to continue. But again, if you're going to dwell on that, then, you know, you don't belong in the business. You know, life must go on.
How much did the danger creep into your mind?
I never dwelled on that negative. You cannot do that. I mean, that's what we knew. I mean, we always knew that we could make things better, you know, but every safety feature in a race car was a performance penalty. So
right.
unless it's designated, it's in the rule book, mandatory to do, you're not going to have anybody volunteer, you know. So that's when a lot of this, and you talk about, you know, the Jackie Stewarts, you know, and Niki Laudas, and that's how we formed the GPDA. For what? To be able to just trying to get the sanctioning bodies to impose safety features not only on the car but on the tracks as well.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the tracks. I mean, but today's standard. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So and it took a long time, but I said this a million times. I don't think the sport would have survived as it became more and more commercial unless safety was dealt with vigorously. Because I always said that companies that spend millions of dollars to be part of a team, they don't want to go to funerals. They want to celebrate. There's a lot of pride that goes into that and everything. And it took a while, you know, but it was a work in progress, which it still is, by the way. And things got better and better and better where, you know, the blessing is that today's drivers have the best chance ever to retire on their own terms, which is a good thing for the sport.
You're mentioning some of these tracks and some of the standards, especially today versus then. I know this goes a little backwards in time, but Langhorne, what was that track like?
Oh my goodness. That track claimed more champions' lives, you know, than any other. You know, when it was dirt, especially. And, you know, when they paved it finally, I think it was a little safer because when it was dirt, turn one, they called Puke Hollow, they used to call it. And they used to dig up, because there used to be a dumping site, I think, way back, God knows when. But it was soft, and I mean, the ruts used to be like, you know, a 6-inch dip. And I remember the first race that I drove there, my hands were like hamburger, you know, because, you know, steering, you go through there. And as you go through those ruts, you have to do it. And God forbid you back off. I mean, you had to just stand on it, just boom, bust through it. You back off, you know, you just go.
Yeah.
And that's what claimed a lot of the guy. That was a brutal place, but awesome to
a challenge.
If you make it at the end, you know, it was a great challenge.
Yeah. I want to touch on something that you said a few times. And I think it's so relevant to people trying to come up through the ranks and race today, but the financial aspect of it. How tough was it to navigate that, especially early in your career? I know your wife even had to go back to work to help, you know, sustain, you know, income for a family. Like, what was that time like in terms of having to pay for racing?
Well, I got it. Give you the story about my wife. You know, I had to put her to work because the way I got the TQ midget, I got her dad to invest to buy it, he and the partner that he had. And I said, the deal was, I says, you buy that car for me. That was the only way I could get one. Mm-hmm. And I said that, and I will share with you, I'll give you 50% of everything that car earns. And when I don't need it anymore. When you sell it, you know, it's all yours. Mm-hmm. Deal that nobody could refuse. but there was a maintenance aspect of it. I was driving that indoors. So the car, if you had just a puff of smoke coming out of the exhaust, you were done for the evening. They park you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to have fresh heads. And it was a Triumph 800 engine. Motorcycle engine in it, and I had fresh heads every single weekend, you know, because I had that new valve guides and all that stuff. Well, that's where the smoke would come from. So, and that was costing me like $150 to, and then we used to pick up the heads at the motorcycle shop, you know, on the way to the races, you know, in New Jersey. And like I said, I had to have that $150 all the time. So my wife, she worked at the blouse factory. That was really her paycheck, you know. And then she was pregnant with Michael, our first child. And so on the way over to the track, you know, we were going to stop at Bob's cycle shop. And she's going, I says, "What's the matter?" "Oh, nothing." You know, she's going like this. I says, "All right, tell me." She says, "I quit my job." I said, "You quit your job? How am I going to pay for these heads now?" Oh, poor Deanne. You know, she said, "I'm 7 months pregnant." So, that was one of it, one of those things. But the other one was that basically, I always said, you know, I loved it so much. I mean, this was my rodeo. This is my dream. And I said, I'm not driving for the money, you know. But I had to. You had to be reasonably. I lost my closest friends. And I look at young families, you know, Billy Foster and so on and so forth. And I see just, what their wives, you know, what they were going through. And so I figure at least, you know, one thing I can do is I can provide, if this, God forbid, happens to me, that they will be cared for. So I had to, you know, believe it or not, I mean, I went for the best contracts and I wanted to earn. And it was, you know, for all the reasons, but primarily I had that in my mind. I was justifying my selfishness to obviously do what I did, even though it was dangerous, by said, "I'm earning enough then. You know, that you will be taken care of, you'll be cared for, you know, for the rest of your life. That's what you do, you know, without me." And that was another objective too, you know, just, man, go for it, you know what I mean? And I was driving everything I could. Not because, like, but it was working good for me because, you know, I said I had a great excuse.
Poor Deanne too, right?
And Deanne was so wonderful. She was trooper. I mean, what was, you know, you never really realize until later on in life when you reflect on things, how good she was for me. Mainly, never, ever, ever did she make me feel guilty, you know, for being selfish and, you know, to do this. I mean, I get reminded sometimes by my daughter Barbie, said, "You were not at my graduation." I said, "I know." I had to race. And I tell you, there's another story I got to tell you. Michael, the oldest one, when he was still young, you know, he was just in school, I think it was second or third grade. And the teacher said, was asking all the kids what their dads did for a living. And it comes to Michael, he says, "My dad goes to the airport and makes bread." And I said, "What?" Because every time, you know, I have my, you know, luggage and everything else. "Dad, where are you going now?" I said, "Well, I got to go to the airport and make the bread."
And that's what you thought you did? Yeah,
that's what you thought I did.
Oh, my gosh.
Good old Mike.
Bringing home the dough.
Now he's making the bread.
When did he find out what you actually did?
A little bit later. Yeah. My dad goes to the airport and makes the bread.
Oh my gosh. That had to be funny to hear. And the other kids,
that's
probably
a fact.
Like, yeah. Gosh, that is funny. I didn't know that. You mentioned, you know, losing people that were close to you, and you brought up Billy Foster. I know you had a conversation with him, you know, before he passed. What was that conversation like?
Well, here's Billy Foster, responsible in every way. And, you know, he's coming from the far west. I'm coming from the far east. We blend here, right here in the Midwest. and both have the same ambitions and so on and so forth, and we have young families, and I'm still driving sprint cars. Mm-hmm. And he said, Mario, you're crazy. You know, I said, this stage of your career, you don't need to be driving sprint cars. You know, and because I think by any stretch of my door, the most dangerous of the, you know, racing cars to drive at that time. And he was driving stock cars. The USAC stock cars, and also did some NASCAR. And as fate would have it, you know, we're in Riverside for the Riverside 500, and I'm actually, we're rooming together, you know, even. And happy, you know, both driving a stock car. And so I'm ready to qualify right after him. He's out to qualify, and front brake explodes going in turn 9, and he just pancaked into the wall, was killed him instantly. And that's because of him, I think, ultimately the net was mandated in NASCAR. Tragic, here it is, you know, a family that we were as close as you could be, you know, like his wife Beverly and the kids, you know, and then to see this and the agony that my wife was experiencing at the time. You see what I mean? So close, you know, to us. And these are all the things that, you know, let's face it, I felt the responsibility, no question. But at the same time, I always felt, you know, he wouldn't give up. He would, if that would have happened to me, you know, he'd keep going. So I always use that excuse, true or not, you know, but it happened. I mean, I think in two accidents, I think in 64, two sprint car accidents. And one we lost Judd Larson and Red Regal in Redding, Pennsylvania. And later on at Ascot, we lost Don Branson and Dick Atkins. Dick Atkins was my teammate with Wally Muskowski. I mean, two accidents, four guys gone. You know, and let's face it, I mean, I'd never like to talk about that side of it, but realistically, at the beginning of the season, at the first driver's meeting, you look around, you said, I wonder who's not going to be here at the end. I mean, that was the reality, you know, and that's the sport was cruel in those years, you know, no question about it. But you know, you had to overcome that with just passion, and love for doing what you're doing. True, true passion. Otherwise, there's no way you could exist.
So there you have it. That was part two of our conversation with Mario Andretti. I'm bringing in our social media coordinator, Dalton Greco. Dalton, welcome.
Hi, how's it going? Yeah, super, super cool. Super happy to be on here.
I was excited to share this interview with you. Obviously, like, you being in charge of social media, man, you've got a tough job of, like, having to know everything that goes out. And, you know, hopefully we've given you some good stuff to work with so far.
You know, it's funny. Before I started working here, I digested, like, everything Dirty Mo Media did. And now I have to do that for work. And so it's kind of like, it's almost like bittersweet because it's like, I still want to be a fan and I still am. But there's definitely a part of me that's like, wow, I really have to lay eyes on I can't just pick and choose. And it's opened my eyes to the whole world of what Dirty Mo Media is. And I'm happy to be able to experience things exactly like this, exactly like Next Level with Mario Andretti. So yeah, it's been a wild ride, but a lot of fun.
We were literally just 10 minutes ago going over what we think the second and third and fourth YouTube videos should be, and like, mm-hmm. Oh man, what are the killer moments
right
from those? And like, it was hard to pick and choose. We're like, well, maybe we just like cut four social videos out of this one YouTube video because you know, there's so much good stuff there. Like, what from what you've heard has stood out to you from what Mario's had to say?
You know, it's funny you bring up like us trying to figure out the YouTube video, going over all that content. I was like, I don't want to cut any of it. It's all so good. So, man, just listening to him, you know, first of all, like just to preface how I feel about Mario Andretti, if he's not on your Mount Rushmore of motorsports drivers or just personalities, then I'd like to know who is, because he is just a phenomenal, you know, obviously entity in the sport and storyteller, and the things that this man has experienced is, you know, just, it's so engaging. And so from this exact episode, my favorite parts definitely have to be him talking about his family. You know, he gets very deep into what it's like to be a driver in a dangerous time of motorsport and how that affects not only his wife, but his kids, himself. So he talks about, you know, the highs and lows of it.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think anyone can relate to, being, you know, it, life gives you highs and lows, but at such an extreme that he was experiencing it. And so, you know, he talks about losing a teammate and then how his wife reacted to that afterwards, you know, being that she was having, you know, they were having kids and he wanted to provide for his family. I think, you know, any man would want to do that. And but knowing every week that you're strapping yourself into a car and that you might not make it out, but your passion just takes you to keep going. It takes a lot of mental fortitude for someone to do that. And that's what makes Mario Andretti special is, you know, not the average man could not. And so, you know, he goes into those deep moments and then he gets to like the funny moments of, you know, the story about Michael where he goes,
I love that.
It's so good. It, you know, where he says, you know, but he had a you know, sharing show and tell or whatever it was at school where they ask him, you know, who, what does your dad do for a living? He says, my dad goes to the airport and makes bread.
Yeah.
And that's just so funny. Like, it, and the funny thing is that like the word bread for money now is like, you know, it's
making
used
that
in
dough,
like, yeah, it's know? Like, it's used in like pop culture and whatever. Yeah. And for like Mario Andretti to say that, I was like, that's so cool. Like, he's such a gangster.
I can't believe like, you know, I think he said he was in second or third grade. Like, that's genuinely mm-hmm. what he thought his dad
did.
Yeah,
my dad goes to the airport and he makes bread.
That is so wholesome. I think that's awesome.
I know. It was really, really, it was really cute to hear that story. And man, he's got a mind like a steel trap.
Really,
I mean,
does.
He remembers everything. It's very, very wild to hear how accurate he is about those details.
I mean, I think I pointed a clip out to you. I asked him, you know, when he was racing in the F1 World Championship, and he was also racing in another race in the United States that same weekend. And that was, I mean, his F1 debut, that is. And I'm like, how did you deal with the jet lag? He's like, well, you know, it was fine. You know, I remember we had to catch a flight to Boston. Then there was an 8 o'clock to, you know, Italy. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
You remember the times?
Man.
That was very impressive. Like, I don't think I would be able to recall that about a flight I took, you know, 2 weeks ago, let alone, you know, however long, what was it, back in 1970-something, early 70s.
Whatever it was, 2, 3,
yeah.
I don't know.
That is impressive. And you see that throughout the entire conversation, which I think is cool.
Yeah, and you know, he rounds it out in such a, you know, somber way, or at least gets to a part where he starts to talk about how, you know, being a race car driver, one of the things that you take with you into that career is that, you know, you look around and you think, you know, which one of these guys is not going to be here anymore? And I, it's such a somber, like, you feel his emotion when he says mm-hmm. it. He like almost gets emotional. I don't know if he does or not. Like,
in his eyes.
Right. But he, like, you can feel it. If he didn't, he would, you could, it was definitely transferred to you. I mean, during that moment. And, you know, it was, that's the beauty of sports, and that's the beauty of what we get to do here is tell this story, and the story that goes from such a high of having kids and funny moments to a low of, you know, I don't know what tomorrow is going to look like. I don't know if there will be a tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad that there was, because now we have this wonderful opportunity to share Mario's story with all of our Dirty Mo fans. So.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. Well, we've got more Mario Andretti coming our way. He talks about winning the Daytona 500, which I think, amazingly, winning the Daytona 500 is kind of an underrated stat for Mario Andretti, but he goes completely into the story. He walks me through the entire weekend. We talk innovation stories. You know, we love hearing those on the download. Mario had one that was fascinating without giving too much away. It's a term that engineers and NASCAR and, you know, IndyCar, they it's a concept they use now. Well, Mario talks about discovering it because it was unknown at the time. And that was fascinating. And you will have to tune in next week to hear what that is exactly. But there's a lot of more, as I use the word gold, there's a lot more gold coming with more of this conversation with Mario. So, Dalton, thanks for taking a little bit of time to share your thoughts about Mario.
And yeah.
We're looking forward to the next couple of batches.
Yeah, I'm so excited. I'm on the edge of my seat. I am right now on the edge of my seat. Being able to put this out to all of our fans, I don't know how all of them aren't just like, I'm fully entranced in this series, and I hope that for the fans who follow it, that you are getting as much out of it as I am.
Yeah, well, this is what I love about the podcast. The YouTube, it's like, man, we got to find the highlights to put on YouTube, but this is where the interview lives in full, unedited. And I'm excited to share some more, so tune in, stay tuned for next week. We're gonna be bringing back some more Mario Andretti on his kind of little mini residency here at Dirty Mo Media. Thanks for tuning in. It's been Andrew Curl and Dalton Greco. We'll see you next time.
Check out Dirty Mo Media on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Dirty Mo. Dirty Mo.